Welcome to Crime Corner, where we examine all things crime, whether it be on the page, on the screen, on the street, or in the courtroom. I'm Matt Coyle, author of the Rick Cahill Crime Series, and I'll be your host for as long as it takes. My guest tonight is Glenn Hamilton, whose debut novel, Past Crimes, won everything. Won the Anthony, McCavity, and Strand Magazine Critics Awards for Best Novel, and was nominated for the Edgar, which is like winning about five other awards, the Barry and the Nero Awards. Publishers Weekly and Library Journal gave Past Crimes starred reviews, and Kirkus called it an exciting heir to the classic detective novel. His next two Van Shaw novels also earned starred reviews, and Mercy River, the fourth in the series, was just published by William & Morrow in the U.S., and Faber & Faber, if I'm pronouncing that right, in the U.K. Glenn is the president of the Southern California chapter of Mystery Writers of America. He's a native of Seattle and grew up aboard a sailboat. How many people can say that? Finding trouble around the islands and marinas and commercial docks of the Pacific Northwest. He now lives in California, probably not on a boat, with his family, but frequently returns to his hometown to soak up the rain, which sounds like a great title for a novel. Welcome, Glenn Eric Hamilton.
Great to talk to you, Matt.
Yeah, that's quite an intro. It could go on and on and on, too.
that was quite the rundown, yeah.
Yeah.
We even got into childhood on the sailboat. And no, I'm not calling from a boat. This is not a ship-to-shore call.
This is pretty good, yeah. This is actually, Glenn, hard worker that he is calling from his company's, one of the boardrooms?
Yeah, one of the conference rooms here after hours, not using company facilities on the for my own dime.
I wasn't trying to out you. So tell our listeners a little bit about Mercy River, the fourth Van Shaw book, and after that, or however way you want to do it, tell us a little bit about Van.
Sure. So Mercy River, as you mentioned, is the fourth in the series. Van is, I'll intro Van a little bit. Van's an unusual beast. He was raised in Seattle by his grandfather, and his grandfather was an immigrant from Northern Ireland during the times of the Troubles and settled in Seattle. And part of the reason that he left that country and eventually settled into the sort of open territory of the west coast of the U.S. is that he was a professional criminal. He was a thief by trade and somewhat of an armed robber in his youth as well. And he matured, if that's the right word, into being a very careful and measured approach to his burglary and other crimes, and raised Van in that life and with those skills. Van went into the military as a very young adult, and found a home there, and served with the 75th Regiment and the Army Rangers. And the arc of the series really is about Van's homecoming and settling, although I don't think that's quite the right word, trying to make his way in the polite society where his background, both not only in the military, but also, of course, being raised in crime and being very good at crime, doesn't make the cleanest fit for a quiet life, and he's not prone to that anyway. So in Mercy River, the latest adventure, he receives a call from a character we've met before in the series, a soldier who served under his Ranger platoon, under him in the Ranger platoon in Afghanistan, named Leo Pack. And Leo has been arrested for murder and robbery in a small town called Mercy River, as you might guess, in Central Oregon. Leo has had his troubles in the past, both with post-traumatic stress and just generally with the law. Van rushes down to help, only to find his surprise that the small town is essentially being invaded by a large gathering of special operations veterans of the Ranger Regiment like himself, who are there for a three-day party / charity gathering / general dust-up called the Rally. And the town, not to give any spoilers, but the town has made something of a Faustian bargain with the Rally, where they get a tremendous influx of cash and other influence, but at the same time give up a fair amount of control. And there's some history there on both sides that comes out in the story. And I thought it would be fun to, after three books, to surround Van with men with shared experience, like himself, who would have served during wartime and would have served in the regiment, and have him have conversations that he hasn't already had.
Now, when he gets this call from Leo, he drops everything and goes. Why is he so compelled to, so to speak, take the case? Obviously, Leo's a friend and a former, you know, buddy in the, as a ranger, but is there something else that would compel him to drop everything?
Yeah. In addition to the shared history that the two men have, you know, Leo pulled it together and was able to come to Van's aid in one of his earlier books and his earlier adventures. And Van owes him to a certain extent for that. He also is really unclear whether Leo has had something of a relapse into violence to a large extent. He doesn't necessarily believe that Leo would be the type to do something like this, but he's only about 90% convinced, and he really needs to see for himself and check on his friend and determine whether he's got his head on square.
Just to go back to the rally, which I think of as a hootenanny. did you find something like this in research? This sort of getting together, big party in the middle of nowhere?
Well, there's nothing of this scale that I'm aware of along the way. There are certainly gatherings where things get crazy, as it will when you have, you know, guys with a lot of friendship, a lot of camaraderie, a lot of a certain amount of wildness in their veins are going to get together and throw down. But at the same time. And had a lot of alcohol. But the real idea for this came from learning about an official Army event that happens every 2 years called the Ranger Rendezvous and looking into that and hearing stories of that. The Ranger Rendezvous is an official event, of course. It happens at Fort Benning every couple of years, which is the home to the regiment. And they have shooting competitions and combatives competitions, and they have, you know, parachute drops and meet and greets with famous Rangers and generals from the regiment. And they, you know, a lot of it's official, but it's quite the party as well. You know, they use it as a time to cut loose a little bit. And I thought, well, what if there was one of these on the West Coast? You know, sort of for the guys who are in Fort Lewis McChord, which is where the 2nd Battalion of the regiment is. And what if it was private? What if it was privately run and set up? And what would that be? And it seemed logical to make it something of an organized thing around a charity drive / charity foundation kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I liked the idea of it being a little unhinged, and you know, being private, they can get a lot crazier than men on base can.
I happen to know a little bit about your background, and I don't believe it included service, unless you can call acting part of the service.
No.
Michael Scott might, but I think in listening to what you just said, I think it's obvious that you did a lot of research, and when you read the book, I mean, you really get a sense that Van is an ex-Ranger, or if there ever are an ex, like maybe you're always a Ranger. But I mean, you feel that it's real. So my question is, what kind of research have you been doing throughout all this time writing these books? Do you have Ranger buddies, or you found some somewhere?
Yeah, I kind of backed into having Van into the military originally. This is going way back when I was formulating the first book and trying to determine who this character was. I wanted Van to grow up with crime, and I wanted him to escape that. And when he escaped it, I didn't want him to just be away, like, you know, he decides to move to Ohio or something. I wanted him to be away. And it seemed logical that at age 18, having no money, no prospects, literally being on the streets, that a fit, smart young guy would maybe look to the military as a place to go, at least temporarily, right? His feet underneath him for a little while. And as I said, to his surprise, he found out that he was really good at it, that, you know, the discipline instilled in him at a young age by his very strict grandfather and his own natural ability just found a home there and a way to succeed and excel. And so So once I decided, okay, yeah, he's going to go into the military, I started looking into different branches of it. And a friend of mine who was in the Special Forces for about 10 years, he and I were talking about the different branches of Army Special Ops, and he talked about the Rangers. And to clean up the language a little bit, he described them as knocking down doors and blowing stuff up. You know, they are light infantry troops. They're anywhere in the world in 18 hours. They're generally dropped in by parachute or fast rope helicopter and marching and you know, humping it in on foot to accomplish a specific objective. You know, whether that's grabbing a person who's a high value target, whether that's grabbing intel like in the form of laptops, whether that's literally blowing something up. You know, that is what they do. They are raiders. And I thought that is exactly the kind of job that would appeal to a guy like Van at age 19, right? That's what he would want to be doing and what he would be drawn to. And so, again, I kind of used contacts to find guys who had served in the regiment and started interviewing them, and some of them have become friends, and I get a chance to chat with them in detail about stuff. And when I'm Mercy River is the first book, although I've had sections of books that have had flashbacks to Van's military service. Mercy River is the one where it's really kind of central, and his early life in the regiment is central to the story. And so even though it's not all a prequel, it's not all a flashback to that time. But I wanted to surround him with military guys and have them talk like military guys, with you know, cleaning up the language a little bit. In order to do that, I felt confident enough after three books that I knew Van and I knew enough about the regiment that I thought I could write this and take a shot at it. But still, did a lot of homework, sent a lot of pages past my contacts, asked them to check it, not just for accuracy of terminology, but for accuracy of mindset. You know, is Van thinking like someone with that experience would in this tactical situation, right? Is he, you know, is he entering a room right? Is he, you know, looking for his field of fire correctly? Is he approaching this in the way that somebody who's trained to do this at a very high level would do? And you know, as I like to say, the cool stuff is theirs and the mistakes are mine, right? But the good news is I've gotten good, it was a long-winded way around it, but I've gotten, you know, excellent feedback from folks in the military who have read this, Rangers and non-Rangers, and they're giving it a thumbs up, at least the ones that have been kind enough to respond, so I'm very happy about that. I feel like I'm doing it justice.
Well, from a layman reader, it certainly comes across as authentic. As does, you made the point that I wanted to shout out to all of our criminal listeners out there. Your discipline as a criminal can help you later in life if you want to go in the military. I just want to let you know. but not only the Rangers, which you nail, but the security technology, I think you've obviously done some research on too. Like KJARR security camera. Very cool.
Yeah, the car security is fictional, by the way. It's a Norton. You know,
really?
I just had the notion of, well, let's make a Nordic security firm, and use that. And so I invented that wholesale. But yeah, I do what research. I need to, I'll put it that way, about specific crime techniques and so forth without getting too in the weeds or too technical. You know, we live in a very digital age, and of course security systems and so forth tend to be the higher end ones, very digital and wireless in nature. And I want to, you know, I want to use that, but I don't want to have it be an instruction manual for hacking or any of that nature. But I do like using that. And that said, I will often take real things and tweak them just a little to make them work for the story, however I need to.
All right. So the technology was legit, more or less, but you just made
yes.
the name.
Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly.
It kind of made me think of ice cream, but maybe that's just because I like hot dogs.
You're hungry at the time of reading. I got it.
I'm going to ask you, and I have a reason for this, to give me a one-word answer, which I think I know the answer to this, and then I'm going to do something after you do.
All right, word association, fair enough.
Is Mystery River a fictitious town?
Yes.
Okay, people. I never do this, but I'm going to read something from the book. And I generally don't do it for a couple reasons. One being that sometimes I'm not a good reader, but I just thought, because I had a feeling that Mercy River, and then I looked it up online. And there are a lot of Mercy Rivers, but no town. I actually looked up Mercy River, Oregon, and like it populated in my search engine. So I'm wondering if I looked it up earlier. But anyway, but I thought, well, maybe there is one, but there isn't. So this is the beginning of chapter 3. I'm just going to read maybe one sentence. The town of Mercy River lay in a haphazard jumble in the crease between two colliding hill ranges, as if its buildings and houses had been scattered across the land like big handfuls of dice, most of them tumbling to rest on the floor of the valley with a few dozen strays left on the slopes above. All right, that is, to my point of view, excellent writing. And it made me wonder if Mercy River is clearly, as we know now, not the readers, fictional, but that is such a descriptive passage. Did you pull that from somewhere that you go to, somewhere up in Washington?
I didn't pull it from a specific place. The topography I did, you know, when I was writing the book, and I was most of the way through the first draft, and I decided, okay, I have not been to this region for a long time, since I was pretty young, and I wanted to go up there. So I actually went with my daughter, who was 9 at the time, and she and I flew up to Portland, rented a car, and drove around, putting some hundreds of miles on this little rental car in the very short span of days, to look at the landscape and kind of look at the ghost towns and everything that's out there. I say in the acknowledgments at the end that I take full license to play with geography or jurisdictions or whatever I have to do to make the story. And I certainly did that with Central Oregon. The landscape is very much Central Oregon, but I've taken a lot of cool parts of Central Oregon and kind of grouped them together around Mercy River so that I can use them. Like the volcanic fields and the buttes and stuff are farther apart in real life than they are in the book. However, It is very much kind of the spirit of the towns out there, where they tend to be in valley ranges like that. They tend to be, of course, grouped around water, as towns are in rural areas. And having this one, you know, near a fictional river and taking its name from that just made a lot of sense. And so getting that spirit of the region, which is this high plains desert, very arid, quite cold in the winter. Not the heavy forest that people tend to think of when they think of the Northwest, although there are certainly lots of forests in the lowlands. But up that high, it'll be more spread out, and you'll have bighorn sheep, and you'll have a lot of deer, and you'll have, you know, probably the occasional mountain lion, although that's pretty rare, and things of that nature, no pun intended.
That is just an example of some of the really lovely writing throughout the book. It's a very good read. It's a good story, of course, and things aren't always what they seem, by the way. We'll just drop that in. But if you like the language, you should read Glenn, but specifically this book, Mercy River. Anyway, I just want to say that because I was really struck by the writing. We already talked about that. Is Van still a criminal? Is he a do-gooder in criminal clothing, or is he some of both?
Van's sense of law and Van's sense of justice are two different things. You know, he's not somebody who is going to steal from innocent people anymore, from citizens. You know, he hit that moral block early in his life and wrestled with it. He doesn't take those sorts of things idly. He sees the human cost of what he does. But you know, if he needs to break into a place, he breaks into a place, right? If he needs to commit a crime to make things happen the way he thinks they should happen, he's gonna do that. And whether he should be looking more closely at himself in that is a fair question. I think he certainly makes some choices in Mercy River that he can't walk back. And if atonement is even something that he cares about or should care about, you know, that's something that's going to prey on him a little bit.
So we mentioned that Mercy River is the fourth Van Shaw novel, and those who follow Glenn on social media know that he just signed recently signed a contract for books 5 and 6 in the series, correct?
Yes, 5 and 6.
So when you were writing the first Van novel, Past Crimes, did you think, well, I'm writing a series here, I'm writing a book, I just want to get published? What was it like?
Yeah. I have this way of dialing down my expectations, not necessarily to avoid disappointment, but when I was first into the writing, you know, I first started writing thinking, let me find out if I like writing. And I did. And so I started taking some classes to see if I could get better at it, to a state where, you know, I was pleased with it and learned more about it simply because I was enjoying the nuts and bolts of it. And then the goal became, well, maybe I can write a book. And then it was, well, okay, I've pretty much written a book now. I wonder if it can get published, you know. And it was never this driving need necessarily that I had to see my book on a shelf. It was more to see whether I could actually do that, whether I could accomplish that. And it was pretty early on that I realized, oh, I like this enough that I want to write more than one story about this character. I want this to be a series, largely because it was a pretty rich milieu I thought I was working in. I liked the character enough, I wanted to learn more about him. And the advantage of writing a series is I think you assemble a cast of characters, as you have in the Cahill novels. You know, you get to revisit these people and have them bounce off each other in different ways and in different combinations. And that's a lot of fun. You know, having characters from different books meet and interact in new ways is always kind of a joy.
So when you decided, well, yeah, I'm writing a series out, there's more to tell this guy's story, did you have an idea for a character arc, or is that something that you started to build later, or it's still something that's not completely sketched out for you?
Yeah, I don't have a master plan over 10 books by any means, but I have a pretty clear idea of where the story needs to go to continue to drive conflict in Van and tough choices about how he's going to grow. And he's not always going to grow necessarily in the right direction, but he is, you know, the events of these books are going to change him and are going to, you know, impact his life. He doesn't reset at the beginning of every novel. He's certainly a different guy at the end of book 4 than he is in book 1.
I think that if that's the way I write a series as well, and that's the way I like to read a series. But some people do reset. But your answer kind of rolled into the next question I wanted to ask you. We do have a lot of writers in stages of their careers that listen to the show, and so we'll just get a little bit into the process. And you kind of touched upon it with that answer. Which comes first for you? Is it the plot or the idea of how you're going to test Van in this particular book, in each particular book?
Yeah, that's an intriguing question, because I don't think I have a clear pat answer to that. I often, you know, sometimes a book will start like with the situation, like Mercy River started because I thought, this would be really cool if we had a private gathering of rangers who were just going, you know, crazy in this town. And that led me to, well, we haven't really seen Van around a lot of other rangers before. And what would that be like? And what would he, you know, what sort of choices do that confront for him and thoughts to that confront? And then correspondingly, where's his arc right now in his life and what he's trying to do and what he's trying to get to and figure out. And then the two combine, right? So this one was situational. This started with Mercy River and sort of went on from there. This next book that I'm writing now is less situational than it is character arc driven, in the sense that, oh, I know where Van needs to be at the end of this book. What is a situation that will drive him to get there? Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have come at it both ways, and I think whatever excites me about writing the story will, I hope, be exciting for the reader. Right.
Right. Right. So I mentioned that you are the prez of MWA Southern California. Mm-hmm. What made you want to run for office?
It was not a lot of running involved. It's more, you know, being a volunteer organization, it's more like, okay, who's willing to pick up the mantle for a year or two to do this?
You had to be voted. There were votes. There were votes.
There are. Oh yeah, there are absolutely votes. Yeah, no question. We run it officially. There's an election app that we use, and it's above board, and you can take write-in votes, you can take candidates, all that sort of stuff. That said, there's usually not a lot of conflict for the positions, and I stood for it largely because our friend Elizabeth Little, our former SoCal president, was stepping out of the role and asked if I would be willing to step in. Liz served for a year, and was originally the plan was that she was going to do a second year, and I would be her VP for a year. Instead, she had to step out earlier just because of family scheduling concerns, and so I kind of jumped straight into the fire and took that on. She set us up for success with a lot of help, and so that was pretty useful. It's moderately time consuming, I would say, but the chapter and our board are really good, and we can do a lot of things like offering ad hoc pro bono classes, you know, at libraries and other things, and panels, and then get the whole subsidized luncheons so that we can have guest speakers and go to festivals like LA Times and Tucson and things of that nature, and try to do as much as we can for our members who are. Although there's a lot of them in the LA area, you know, it's pretty widespread, as you know, being in San Diego. And we're always trying to get things rolling as best we can in the farther flung areas for our members out there.
And there's a big event coming up in 2 months.
There is a big event coming up in 2 months, which is thank you for the segue. It's the California Crime Writers Conference, CCWC. We hold it every 2 years in partnership with Sisters in Crime LA. So our chapters get together and throw a two-day conference on mystery writing craft for about 200 attendees. We are close to being sold out, but not completely sold out. For those of you listening to this who are interested in writing craft, this is an excellent conference to go to because it is small enough that you can get a lot of interaction both with each other and with our guest instructors and the panels. And our guests of honor this time around are Tess Gerritsen, author of the Rizzoli and Isles Mysteries, among many others, and Katrina McPherson, the current lefty award winner and multiple award winner for both her standalones and her humorous series. Yeah. So we're delighted to have them as our guests. They're going to be fantastic.
And on a personal note, this is actually the conference where I met my ultimate agent. Met her, and a few months later, I had an agent. So there is a lot of opportunity for that. I highly recommend going if you're in a situation where you're working towards getting to the next step. So, obviously, you told us a little bit about what's next. You have two books you're responsible for, and it sounds like, mm-hmm. How far are you through on the next one?
I'm a little more than a quarter through writing book five for Van. The delight of it is, in addition to having a few months to write it, you know, during the spring and summer, I know what the book is. I really know what it's about, and it's always nice to launch into a book knowing where it needs to go. You know, so
it's not that's that way, is it?
That's you know, I've done it the other way, and it's tougher. Mm-hmm. It's a lot tougher. It's much better to write a book kind of knowing, oh, okay, this is what's going to happen. This is what he's going to discover. And then I've got some freedom to, you know, noodle with it and have fun with subplots and have fun with characters. So, I'm looking to kind of front load the writing of it so that my month or two leading up to the turning in of the manuscript in early September, aren't quite as harrowing for me and the family as they often can be.
Well, if you're turning it in September, what's the pub date?
The pub date would be summer, early summer 2020. You know, so there's about an 8 to 9 month lead time. And I recently learned some interesting facts about that real fast. Part of the reason that lead time is getting so much between the turning into the manuscript and the rewrites, you know, because you turn, for those who don't know, you turn in the manuscript It takes a few weeks, of course, for your editor, who's always overloaded with work, to read the manuscript, to think about it, to make a bunch of notes, to have a conversation with you about rewrites. You do the, you know, you then you have a few weeks to do the rewrites. You do the rewrites. You turn that in. Then they read that, and then the manuscript is hopefully accepted. And so there's, you know, the turning of the manuscript doesn't mean by any means that you are done. You end up, as you know, Matt, you often end up writing a book in part or in whole, you know, three or four times before you've actually, or at least reading through it, before you're actually done. So the reason these lead times are getting longer is because there are fewer physical printers nowadays. There's fewer companies printing books, and they need more lead time in order to produce things like advanced copies and the printings and so forth. And there are often there are sometimes paper shortages due to a large online book distributor. An online store that I won't name here, but they use a lot of boxes, and a lot of boxes require a lot of pulp. And there have actually been shortages of paper because there just aren't enough paper to produce books because that paper is instead becoming corrugated cardboard boxes.
Well, actually, that's actually a quick turnaround from when you turn the book in to get it out with under a year or so.
It's 8 to 9 months is sort of become the standard the first book took a long time. The first book took like 15 months, but that's pretty normal for like a debut along the way. But each book after that has usually been about 8 to 9 months.
Nice. Okay, so how can people find you online?
Sure. Easy to find. It's Glenn Eric Hamilton, Glenn with one N, Eric with a K, glennerichamilton.com, or on Twitter at Glenn Eric H, and on Facebook as well under the full name. And I always love it when folks who are reading either my books or books that they really like drop me a line and we can chat about it. So I'm a fan of mysteries as well as being a writer of mysteries. So talking books is always fun.
Well, I thank you for coming on. I have to highly recommend Mercy River. It is really a great read, and as I gave the audience a little bit of a taste, there's some great writing in it.
Terrific. Thank you, Matt. Great to talk to you.
You bet. Thanks. Okay, I think I'm coming back in May. No, April. No, May's next, right? I think it'll be May 10th. I'll be here with Dick Belsky, I believe, but find me online. This is a copyrighted trademark podcast owned solely by the authors on the air, Global Radio Network.